Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am honored to be joined by Ashley Rinsberg. He is the author of The Gray Lady Winked, How the New York Times' Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History. Mr. Rinsberg, where is the best place to purchase the book?
Amazon is a pretty good starting point, but Barnes & Noble, for people who are not so into Amazon, is also good, or Book Depository, and those are good options.
Links will be in the description below. Mr. Rinsberg, how would you define fake news?
To me, fake news is something that is pushing an agenda. That's sort of the differentiation I draw between soft bias, which is kind of a natural human thing, which is to include your perspective, your experience in reporting. I think it's to an extent unavoidable. It's something we can work on avoiding, but at the end of the day, we're all human beings and that's okay. But when there's an agenda, when there's a concerted effort towards an ulterior motive. So, you know, Trump, for better or worse, is a great example because the media was pushing an agenda. The agenda was to get Trump out of power. So the narratives that emerged from that were completely false about Russia collusion, where we really don't have the kind of evidence to support, needed to support the really bold claims that were being made at the time. And that's because there was an agenda behind it. It wasn't about whether or not this was true. It didn't matter. What was really at stake was whether this would be effective in helping to remove Trump from office or to damage him enough politically. And that's at that point where you cross over to fake news. And of course, in Trump's case, that's really instructive because he was sort of the one throwing the term around a lot. Maybe not with the kind of precision that we would want, but he actually turned out to be right, because what we saw from that was that there was somewhat of a concerted effort to build this narrative. And that's, of course, only one example. I mean, we could look at throughout history, we could turn to other parts of the world and to other issues, and we see similar effects and similar phenomena.
How can we spot fake news, considering both sides say that it's the other side who engages in it?
I think when you're seeing that there is really too much emphasis given the story, if it's disproportionate to what the story is, that's a red flag right away. So, you know, for example, the New York Times, with regard to its 1619 project, the project that they are trying to redefine American history in terms of slavery rather than liberty. And it's not just that they kind of suggested that that might be an interesting idea, even though it's not clear why a newspaper would be revising history on its newsprint. It's that it's a full issue of the Sunday Times Magazine, followed by a web version, followed by podcast, followed by editorials, op-eds, reporting on the reporting. So they're running news articles about their own reporting and their own reporter. Followed by production deals with Oprah and a book, the 1619 Project book, and a children's book. And we're not even close to being done. I mean, so right away, that's your alarm bell. You're saying, whoa, what's going on here? There's other stuff happening in the world. There's something at work here where we need to start paying attention to understand why are they pushing this so hard. Is the classic line from Shakespeare, "The lady doth protest too much." I think that's one great indicator. And another one is when people are trying to shut down the debate. That's a great red flag where you're seeing that, you know, these are news organizations, they should be open to debate. When there's too much effort to cast the other side as illegitimate, another excellent sign that something is really amiss. And again, that's something we've seen today with the effort to discredit lab leak, the theory that the COVID-19 might have emerged from a lab in China, where the news media came out almost in unison within the first weeks of the pandemic, before a pandemic was actually declared officially, claiming that lab leak was a conspiracy theory. There was, I mean, no evidence among the scientists to make that claim, let alone journalists who had no idea what they're talking about on that topic, especially at that time, that's another great sign. So too much emphasis and a real sort of vigorous, even furious effort to shut down the debate. Those are really, really strong signals that something is not what it seems.
It's amazing. Even though the closest horseshoe bat colony is like 800 kilometers from the wet markets where it allegedly started, which is which is yards away from the Wuhan Lab of Virology. That's according to South China University. That was probably 2 years ago at the beginning of this whole thing, which while Tucker Carlson was reporting on it, seemed something loony. But then Matt Ridley's book Viral came out on the topic, and it's almost like they're controlling the traffic lights in the society. They tell you when to stop. Hey, it's not okay to go here. We didn't allow lab leak. Actually, it's totally okay to go here. Never mind. Imperialism is something evil. Well, actually, in other cases, it can be totally justified. They always say executive orders are evil when Donald Trump does it. Well, Biden is really pushing things forward, and the population's totally ignorant. So it's really a good thing with these executive orders that he's doing. So it's like they're totally controlling. Well, you use the word narrative. What is a historical narrative, and why are historical narratives important?
The narratives that I think about and talk about are media narratives, and in this case, it's something again that shaping an agenda that is rooted in a political end most of the time. And everything, all the facts are kind of just pulled together in a way that proves the point sort of before there's real proof of that point. So it's a foregone conclusion. And that's, again, what we've seen with, you know, any of these major issues with Trump, with the Russian bounties on Trump. That was a great narrative that had a sub-narrative of the larger Trump-Russia collusion narrative. And that narrative was that Russians were paying terror groups in Afghanistan to kill American troops. And of course, this is the caveat, the Trump administration, Trump himself, knew about it and did nothing. So this was something that had no actual evidence. And the media just started to assert it over and over and over. And in some cases, it was a feature story covering it, or some cases it was an op-ed. Some cases it was just casual mentions, as if it's something you can assume to be true that's already taken as sort of a premise in other kinds of reports on other topics or related topics. And again, this is one of these things that has this like strong Manichaean backbone. It's a tale of good and evil, which in other contexts, the media and sort of the America's ruling intellectual elite, they really love to kind of punch down on the notion of good versus evil, bad or good and bad, as being sort of quaint and moralistic. But they very much employ that same structure to create a sort of a morality tale about whatever it is that's at hand. So, you know, this is something we see time and again. We see it, I'm just reading right now, Michael Schellenberger's book on climate change alarmism, Apocalypse Never. And you see, I mean, that is one of the greatest historical or media narratives that we've seen in, I would say, the last 50 years plus. The narrative being very simple, which is that climate change is going to destroy the planet and basically uproot all of our lives, if not kill all of humanity. And that's the basic narrative. And it's not true. It's not supported even by the science that is cited by the people pushing that narrative. So it is very disconnected from evidence and from proof. It is very loose with the facts and the claims. And it also is very sort of self-aware in terms of that gap between facts and claims that it makes. So people can say, science shows that 8 billion people are going to die. That's something that an activist might say from Extinction Rebellion. And when it's pointed out that the scientists didn't actually say 8 billion, he said, maybe it's 1 billion. And they say, oh, well, you know, you get the point. The point is that we're all going to die. So the claim is much more important than the fact. And the moral assertion that's moving towards some sort of political end is really what counts. So the facts are just sort of little puzzle pieces that you can arrange in any fashion that you want.
Because of things like selection bias, you can choose to report on some things and not others, and repetition bias, the ability to repeat something again and again and again and again to keep it at the forefront of the population's mind. Is it almost a fool's errand to say the news should be unbiased? Shouldn't we just say the average reporter is just as biased as the average priest, rabbi, and imam? They're pushing a worldview just like everyone else, so let's embrace competing worldviews. Or is there such thing as objective news that we can pursue rationally?
I think it's all a question of intent and objectives. And, you know, it wasn't so long ago where people had a notion that objective journalism was an ideal to aspire towards. What we've done in the meantime is created a straw man where you say, people are saying to themselves or saying aloud, it's impossible to be objective in journalism. So let's just give it all up and become, you know, CNN, become Don Lemon on CNN and just like spew opinions all day long. Because the other end of the spectrum is impossible to reach. But again, that's a false dichotomy. I think we can aspire to an ideal without actually reaching it, but still try to do our best. We try to do our best to approximate the truth. And I think that's where this is something I write about in the introduction to my book, which is that it's never about one reporter getting the story perfectly right and just, wow, he just, you know, miraculously he or she got that story. It's not that. It's about a bunch of people, almost like scientists, working together to give their best approximation of what happened and leaning on each other and accepting one another's corrections and criticisms in order to create a model that is more reflective of the truth, whatever it is out there. So I think that is the ideal to strive towards, which doesn't mean we need to be perfect human beings, which we all know is not a possibility. But it also doesn't mean that if we're going to throw out that bathwater, we throw out the baby with it. We can still say, okay, we're not perfect. We're not going to do a perfect job here. But let's also not slide back towards just pure opinion spewing for the sake of profit. And that's a real key ingredient here, where today news organizations are owned by a vanishingly small number of major media corporations, or corporations that are even larger than media corporations. So, you know, you have Disney that's owning multiple news stations and outlets and investing heavily. So the parent of the parent of the parent company, who are motivated by share prices, by fiduciary responsibilities to the shareholders, and that pressure devolves to the news organization. And then you end up with CNN or Fox in some cases, or whoever it is that is just pushing their news to the base. And that's a larger trend in American everything, in American politics, in American culture. We're all speaking to the base. We've lost common ground. So it's not just about profiteering. I think it's also about having lost common language, common values, and a common purpose in America, which is something that maybe we can regain. And maybe the media can help regain it, recover it, but not until it says, okay, enough. We're going to cease pandering to the base. We're going to start trying to find a healthier way forward, where we can just say the simple words, you know what, I'm going to listen to what you, the person on the other side of this issue, have to say. And I'm going to try to actually understand what you mean by it. I'm going to try to see where you're coming from for just one second. Doesn't mean I've got to sell my soul to the devil. It doesn't mean I've got to let go of my beliefs or principles. I'm just going to try to understand where you're coming from on this issue. And I think if we're able to just make that simple sacrifice, that's an incredible starting point.
One of the most amazing changes I've seen with New York Times and collaborators is how in, I would say, probably around 2008, 2010, it was really vitally important that we as a society focus on the poor and those who are impoverished. These would be people toward the lower end of the income spectrum. We saw Occupy Wall Street, very favorable reporting on them. Now, after the blue-collar Americans and Europeans supported Brexit and they supported Trump, well, they're a bunch of patriarchal fascists, racists who we never supported anyways. And in fact, the country that they love so much is actually founded on white supremacy, terrorism, and racism. So that they've totally thrown. They've thrown that whole demographic under the bus. Second, it was so obvious that health care companies, anyone in that industry, is just profit seeking like anyone else. And this is why the state needs to step in and assist with, curbing the profit seeking of pharmaceutical agencies. But now, anyone who questions these agencies, well, you're an anti-vaxxer, you're a conspiracy theorist. If you think there's any side effects to any medicine that's produced by Big Pharma, who's paid tens of billions of dollars in fines for explicit corruption, well, then you're absolutely crazy. So with this, do you see a pattern in how groups like the New York Times sort of create enemies that they get people to hate? Any tactics that you could sort of expose so we're less likely to keep falling for this next big boogeyman and we could maybe see things more rationally?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, what you're pointing out is that a tendency to, for the media to want to stage the morality play so that they have a villain, and they, in contrast to the villain, the media organization and the media ecosystem presents itself as the hero, the good guy. So I think whenever we're seeing those kinds of black and whites, pharma is now humanity's greatest savior. And exactly as you pointed out, wasn't very long ago where Martin Shkreli was the devil incarnate. So again, those are the morality plays. And I think it ties back to what I was saying earlier about media narratives, where whenever you're seeing somebody trying to shut down the debate. So we know for sure that Big Pharma, just like big anything, is susceptible to corrupting its own processes. And, you know, Paul Thacker, who runs the Disinformation Chronicle Substack, has reported in the BMJ that some of the clinical trials for Pfizer's vaccine were corrupted because they outsourced the trial process to some other company who screwed it up. We should know this. That should be a front page story in the New York Times. It should be something we all explore. We should all be trying to understand, what are the hesitations with the vaccine? Where is the skepticism coming from? You know, whenever you see that someone is just really, really hesitant to go down a path of open exploration, again, that's where we're seeing that kind of narrative at play. So how can we be wary of it? I think we all have a spidey sense for that. You know, or at least most of us who are not, haven't really thrown down our chips to commit ideologically to one side or the other, or maybe just to commit, you know, for our own financial or personal gain for one side or the other. But we really are open and are honest brokers, and we're trying to understand what's going on. We do have a sense inside of us that something is wrong here, where they're telling you, oh, no, these vaccines are not only they are 100% effective, and they are perfectly safe, but they are going to take us out of this pandemic and cure us forever. And when that turns out to not be true, there's no correction. And I would say that, you know, that's another layer to the media narrative, is that when you see something false comes out and there's not a correction, there's no accountability, and there's no attempt to address whatever the truth that came to light. So what can we do to be resistant to those types of things? It's just allow yourself to question it. I think the weight of a media narrative, the pressure is so heavy, it's so all-encompassing, that it makes you actually feel like a bad person if you're not on board. Resist that feeling. Don't sign on to the morality play so that this is about good and bad people and evil and whatever. It's just about the facts. And I think if we say, put aside the emotional stuff, stick to the logical, reason-based stuff, and look at the facts. And I think that's the only way to do it.
I want to look at, it's amazing that they sort of put themselves in this heads I win, tails you lose kind of scenario, because either they're correct about something or they're wrong, and them being wrong and saying that they, and correcting themselves, is proof that their credibility is just so valuable. So I want to look at this case of, are you able to see my screen now? There is a small excerpt here. So here's a correction on June 29th, 2017 from the Times. A White House memo article on Monday about President Trump's deflections and denials about Russia referred incorrectly to the source of an intelligence assessment that said Russia orchestrated hacking attacks during last year's presidential election. The assessment was made by four intelligence agencies, the DNI, the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. The assessment was not approved by all 17 organizations in the American intelligence community. Now, the reason that that is so vitally important is because this was Hillary Clinton's gotcha line in the debates with Donald Trump. She continuously said 17 agencies have confirmed this. 17. You think all of them are what, liars? They're all crazy? They all just had an accident? No. This is how we know that that it's true. This sort of narrative allows you to get the memos that got them to, gosh, who was it? I believe it was James Clapper ended up tapping the phones of Paul Manafort. Then they got something on him. So it's just these explicit lies. And then notice who they say it was actually from: the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA, the three biggest liars on planet Earth. So they keep narrowing and narrowing it down. When it comes to corrections, is this, as David Frum says, the savior of the fake news, that because they give us corrections, it's proof that they actually are well-meaning?
No, it's definitely not, because if that were the case, the correction would be on page one and not online, you know, in some article that almost nobody's ever going to revisit. This is one of the things I think would the media, one of the steps the media would have to take if it were ever to restore trust, which would be to give the correction as much space and as much airtime and as much publicity as the original mistake. That's a display of intellectual honesty. Front page, this is the story of how the New York Times got this wrong. And let's send the reporter onto Morning Joe to talk about it, and onto a podcast and on Twitter, and let's make this a big deal. It's embarrassing, fine, let's get over the embarrassment. But what's really important here is for us to show how, not just the public, show ourselves as the media, how we went wrong. And we know that militaries that go back, like the Israeli military, is very, about its own failures, strategic and tactical failures, it's pretty thorough. They go back and they really want to understand where things went wrong, because they don't want to do it again. And we, you know, some of Israel's adversaries or enemies have done the opposite. So, up until whenever it was, the Egyptian army was still claiming in public that they won the Six-Day War. That, what that does is create a cycle of corruption that corrodes the institutions themselves. And the same goes with the New York Times. When it finds that it's really easy just to brush over all but the most scandalous, and I'm not even saying most egregious, because the most egregious errors are the ones that are covered up. It's just the most scandalous ones, meaning Jason Blair, the reporter who was just making up stuff in the early 2000s, when he was caught, it was a big scandal. It was like a big media world thing. It was like really gossipy and juicy, and that had a lot of attention, even though his impact wasn't really that great. But something like the Trump collusion stuff is a huge impact. We're talking about the integrity of the elections and the president of the United States of America and a major foreign power. It draws in almost everything. And these corrections are basically non-existent. Technically, they're out there, but in terms of their substantive weight, they might as well not be issued. So that, I think, is one of the places that the media is going very, very, very wrong, is that they're not really making these things a big deal, and instead they're trying to save face and save credibility, but in reality, they're doing the opposite. Because on the topic of Russia and Trump, most Americans, I think by now, have a sense that there was no there. And yet they're well aware that the media was pushing this for a long time. So it has probably done more than anything else in recent years to destroy what's left of media credibility.
There's another traffic light scenario for you. It's vitally important we question the validity of elections because Vladimir Trump more or less controlled last election in 2016. 2020 comes around. Anyone who questions the results of an election, even though this one's different because it had tons of mail-in ballots, you question this election, you're absolutely crazy. You believe in QAnon nonsense. It's the most legitimate thing that's ever existed. I mean, there's like 150 million votes, and they just expect people to believe that there's like no margin of error. Does that happen with any other organization, or is it just government votes? I have one more thing that I want to share with you. This is one of the second biggest things that I've seen the Times really focus on. The editorial board. Every day is January 6th now. Are you able to see this on my screen?
Yeah.
So I'm going to read three excerpts. Talking about how people want to move on from January 6th, they say, this is an understandable impulse after 4 years of chaos, cruelty, incompetence, culminating in a pandemic and the once unthinkable trauma of January 6th. Most Americans were desperate for some peace and quiet. In short, the Republic faces an existential threat from a movement that is openly contemptuous of democracy and has shown that it is willing to use violence to achieve its end. No governing society can survive such a threat by denying it exists. Rather, survival depends on looking back and forward at the same time. Finally, they reference Adam Kinzinger, a Republican. The thing that's most concerning is that it has endured in the face of all evidence, said Representative Adam Kinzinger, one of the vanishingly few Republicans in Congress who remain committed to empirical reality and representative democracy. Kinzinger finishes, and I've got to wonder if there's actually any evidence that would ever change certain people's minds. When you read that, what are some of the things that stick out to you as blatant propaganda? They're continuing to do the same thing they did when they said Poland invaded Germany many moons ago.
I think in that case, it's the title. Every day is January 6th. Every day now. We obviously, that's not the case, right? Today wasn't January 6th, not literally and not figuratively, because there wasn't any protests on Capitol Hill. It was just another day. So what they're saying to you is, we want you to think every day is January 6th. That's just like, I remember many years ago, there was a protest in London against Israel, and people were holding a sign, or many people holding signs saying, we are all Hezbollah now. You know, meaning we want you to think that we are all Hezbollah now. That is propaganda. It is trying to rally people to a cause. It is not trying to offer people a dispassionate and disinterested view of an issue. So in this case, you know, that was a lot of purple language there. It was a lot of polarizing language in that editorial. It was a lot of either or. And again, this is one of those, as you point out, one of these traffic light moments where we say, when it was Bush, George W. Bush saying, either you're with us or you're against us, that to the media and the sort of left-wing apparatus was the worst possible thing you could say. Either you're with us or against us is polarizing and divisive and it tears people apart. That was the line that he'd issued in response to the 9/11 attacks and the world, the posture in relation to America. Today, we have the same thing. The New York Times is just telling you right there, either you are with us or you're against us. Either you're pro-democracy or you are pro-tyranny. And again, that's where you think to yourself, once you start to see the morality play, once you start to see this Manichaean posturing of good versus bad. And of course, it's always the speaker who is on the good side. It's always the speaker who is the hero, and anyone who is not fully in agreement, but anyone who's just not enthusiastically taking up the cause is a villain. So it doesn't leave you much space to exist as somebody in the middle who might say, okay, I look at January 6th. I was pretty horrified. People desecrating the Capitol building and committing acts of violence that I think are horrendous. If I were there and able to shout at all those people to tell them, stop what you're doing, this is horrible, I would do that. That doesn't mean that I think it was a coup d'etat. And it doesn't mean that I also have to believe that it was some sort of planned insurrection. I don't think there really is an empirical basis for thinking that this was some sort of planned attempt to overthrow the United States government. Maybe there was rhetoric referencing that, and maybe there was some sort of, you know, populistic and almost some fabulistic and sort of this fantasy in motion that was just never going to come to play, given who these people are. And we can be in the middle. It's okay. And I think that's the thing that the media hates being in the middle. It's not sexy. It doesn't drive clicks. It doesn't drive ad views. And that is, again, the problem where we come back to, we see a broken model. And I think the point that I always really try to emphasize when I'm talking about the New York Times and in relation to my book is that people often neglect to look at the financial motivations. We're always talking about the ideological motivation, but you have to understand the New York Times, as just one example, as a $10 billion company controlled by a very small number of people who are all family members. And you can just take that model and look at it for NBC Universal, for ABC News, for Vox Media, for just pick any of these major brands. They are financial organizations that at the end of the day are answerable to people who have financial responsibilities to stockholders or to owners or investors. And that's the thing we need to understand here, is that this is a broken model. It's a model that is not, it is perversely incentivized. It is not incentivized to deliver cold, hard fact. It is incentivized to deliver rabble-rousing, fear-mongering, purple, divisive, actionable material that gets people to change their behavior. And the behaviors that they want to change are willingness to subscribe to the New York Times for $10 a month or $5 a month, whatever it is, or to go to a news website and to look at their ads and sign up for their email newsletters, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the heart of the matter, is that we have a broken industry. Just as we've talked for years and years about big pharma and big ag and big finance, we have never really talked about big media. And I think it's probably time that we do.
What do you think is a good place to find media that is less centrally financed and more likely to be unbiased? Do you read Substacks or anything?
Substacks are amazing because, you know, to really run a Substack properly, you have to be committed. So you don't have, I mean, I'm sure there's tons out there that are just kind of like whatever, wishy-washy, whatever they are. But you also have really serious journalists who have left their institutions. If it's Barry Weiss from the New York Times or Andrew Sullivan or Paul Thacker, who I just mentioned, or whoever else. But these are serious journalists writing independently because they can. That's definitely one great place to look. And another great place to look is just podcasts that where you have hosts whom you respect, who maybe they're not reporting, meaning they're not going out and like bringing you the who, what, where, when, why, all that stuff. But they are asking the questions. And that's just as important. Sometimes it's even more important. So this whole controversy with Joe Rogan right now, where should Joe Rogan be thrown off of Spotify for asking questions? Like, Joe Rogan has never claimed that he's a journalist. He's never claimed that he is presenting the gospel on any issue. He's just asking questions to various people. And that's people as, you know, diverse or as wide a spectrum as Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent, to, you know, Dr. Robert Malone, who is a vaccine skeptic, despite his own involvement in developing some vaccine technology. So people who are asking the questions, people who are independent, organizations that are independent, you know, there are great not-for-profit journalistic organizations out there that I think are doing good work. And I would also say that within major media organizations like the New York Times or whoever else, there are really good reporters. So again, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You might find that one or two or three or four or five or whoever, however many reporters at the New York Times are doing amazing work. Josh Rogan at the Washington Post has done excellent work on Lab Leak, where the rest of the media that he is a part of, when he's employed by one of the biggest media companies in the newspaper industry, was against his own reporting on that issue, but he found a way to get the good reporting out there. So I say, find it wherever it is and go out and search for the stuff that's important to you. And don't browse, don't passively consume, actively search for issues that matter to you and find the good sources.
One of the ways that they use social proof to more or less intimidate you into not questioning something or blindly believing something is they'll say, some say X, and whatever comes after, some say, you know, the lockdown should be more intense. Some say that we should increase funding to state schools or anything. Some people say anything. There's 7 billion people on the planet. There's not a single thing that some don't say. So you're clearly selectively choosing those just to bring to the forefront. Or they'll say, many are asking X, and it'll be whatever question that they want to pose, that they want to really grab people's attention with. When it comes to social proof and telling people that it's okay, what are some of the biggest examples you've seen where an idea has gone from totally unapproachable to totally justifiable because the news media has decided to report on it in a certain way? I think something like this would really show the power that the corporate press has. Any come to mind?
You know, I think there's a lot that we've seen regarding the pandemic and a lot of the quote unquote science that the media has presented, whether that's masks being completely ineffective one day and then completely necessary, and if you don't wear a mask, you're a monster the next day. The same thing with vaccines, where one day vaccines are all about ending the pandemic and never getting COVID, and then the next day they're about maybe reducing your chances of getting COVID and not ending the pandemic. There's just a lot of these flips. And of course, Lab Leak as well, where early in the pandemic, we had Lab Leak as a conspiracy theory that you couldn't consider unless you're just a maniac. And a year later, after Jon Stewart comes out and ridicules it on Stephen Colbert, you have Lab Leak as, I wouldn't say they're really eager to embrace it, but at this point, it's like, you're not going to be branded some sort of like fringe element by talking about it or asking questions. These things happen all the time. I think it's really interesting also to see where they don't happen. So we've never really gone back, at least in the media has not gone back on the Trump-Russia stuff to say, oh, that there actually wasn't any major collusion there. Where they've just left it as it is. And when you have a narrative that was built with so much resource, so intensively, in such a sophisticated manner for so long, it doesn't just go away from people's minds the moment that the media stops reporting on it. It's still there. I think there's still some association with Trump and Russia in people's minds. It has never been cleared up. So that's another thing when you mentioned like selection bias and confirmation bias. The other important bias to be mindful of is omission bias. It's what is not reported at all. And that often has the biggest impact on us because we then are not at all aware of that issue is an important one. You know, the trucker convoy right now, it's a lot of people are talking about it because you go on Twitter and it's like all anybody's talking about and taking video of And then you flip back to NewYorkTimes.com and it's as if it's not happening. And you have to say to yourself, wow, this where is the dissonance? Like, where is the gap here? What's which one is more reflective of the reality that I believe ought to be? Like, how much weight should be placed on this event? Is it zero, like the New York Times? Is it 100, like it is for some Twitter handles? Is it somewhere in between? But we know from the discrepancy that something is up. And that omission on the mainstream media is also very telling.
And all of the lockdown protests in places like Australia, in Austria. I've seen them in Italy. Gosh, I think the guy's name is Aaron Berg. There's a lot of people who are just so dedicated to this. Zuby is a great commentator who's always posting these protest videos, which I never hear about from the media. Yeah. If it wasn't for Twitter, I'd literally never hear that there's any European country marching against mandates. And I've even seen them in Israel, even though Israel was very big to grab on to, or at least the ruling elite in Israel was very big to bring the vaccine on board. And now, are you guys getting the fourth shot there to?
Yes, it's being given to at-risk populations and older people. It doesn't seem, I mean, I know someone who is at risk and just got the fourth booster and or the second booster, depending on how you want to find that, and then just got COVID after that right away anyways. But it actually brings your point, brings back one of the most important of those flips that you were asking about, which was the BLM protests and riots. And that was really 1 minute to the next, meaning you weren't allowed to go get pizza or go to a church or a synagogue or say hello to your grandmother because you might kill the entire population of America by doing so, is what we were told. And then suddenly, you've got these BLM protests, Black Lives Matter protests over that summer of 2020. And it's now a medical imperative that you go out and protest in the midst of the pandemic. That, I think, was one of the biggest breaking points for a lot of people in terms of their ability to consider the media to be still credible. That, I think, I keep hearing that again and again and again. The moment the media came out in unison saying, oh, it's actually for our collective health that we all go out into this super of super spreader events and protest, that's where people completely lost faith.
And you can see how, even though they've sort of lost the Trump-Putin collusion, Putin is still this terrible villain, even though it was James Baker and NATO who in 91 promised they would never expand after the Soviet Union dissolved. Putin all of a sudden is this terrible, evil psycho that we need to be terrified of, even though he was allegedly allies with America in the fight against ISIS in places like Syria, along with Soleimani, who they then justify the assassination of. So they're constantly flipping us. One more thing on the COVID narrative. Do you remember, I swear I'm not making this up, right when this came out, of course, we saw Fauci in March of 2020 on 60 Minutes say, there's no reason anyone should be wearing a mask. Sometimes you end up touching your face and it's worse than it otherwise would have been. Do you remember them saying the biggest things to do are wash your hands, wear gloves, don't touch your eyes, nose, and mouth, because that's where the virus can get into you. And then they've just totally dropped. I haven't been told to wash my hands after being told to wash my hands every 5 minutes by AOC and Trump. So that isn't a perfect example of them actually giving you an alleged cure or way to fight this that they just dropped. And then it turns out the cloth masks were the same thing. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. That was sort of part of this whole like wipe everything down thing where
wipe your groceries. Yes.
Yeah. Wipe your groceries, where people were doing that for a long time. And also, you know, right now, if you get onto an airplane, at least an international flight, they give you like a alcohol wipe to like wipe down your seat or whatever, which probably was a good thing to do before the pandemic and will be after it. But there is no evidence out there to my knowledge, and maybe I'm wrong, but you know, I'm following scientists talking about this who are saying that there's no evidence of surface contact having any sort of effect with COVID whatsoever. So, you know, a lot of these things that the scientists, to their credit, you know, you don't want to tear down the science establishment too much because they legitimately don't know these things because it was very early. The problem was that the science establishment, in coordination with the media, was attempting to use social engineering to change our behavior in order to suit their expedient needs at that moment. So in the case of masks, they were saying, don't buy masks. Masks are useless. And of course, the intention there was that they wanted to make sure that the masks were going to hospitals and to medical professionals who needed them. But that's a lie. It's a lie to say, okay, we don't want people buying masks because we need medical professionals to have them. There's a distinction between saying that and saying they're ineffective, and then saying a few months later that they must be worn. And again, that's social engineering to my view, or my understanding of it, because they it's a mechanism of control, essentially. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the masks are fair. Maybe there's some benefit or value. It's not really clear. Certainly little kids wearing cloth masks in schools in New York City is just a joke, but it is some mechanism of social control. And I think, again, where you are as a government putting yourself in the position of hander down of all knowledge and truth, then you get into these kinds of problems where people just don't believe you anymore because they know you're lying because you are. So I think this is where we've gotten to, where the pandemic has really exposed some very damaged relationships and ties between government and people. And I personally feel that it's time for people to understand that they not only can, but must take back power. We need to reconstitute ourselves as a meaningful polity, not just, you know, okay, I'm a resident or a citizen, which is a very passive notion, but a polity that holds power, that in which power actually resides and is shared to the leadership for practical purposes, and nothing more than that. I think we've really lost sight of that. The media has helped us lose sight of that, but we need to change that trend.
The book is The Gray Lady Winked: How the New York Times' Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History. Links in the description below. We have about 12 more minutes here. I want to go over a section in a book titled Knowledge, Reality, and Value by Michael Humer. He says the news is more or less garbage, and he has no problem making this generalization because he says basically all news today that we consume falls into three categories. I'm going to give you a category. Tell me which an example of something that would fall into this category with your extensive research of the New York Times. First one. Ideological propaganda. If you learn about an issue from a partisan source, for instance, you read about gun control on a gun advocacy website, or you hear the day's news from a conservative radio show, you will pretty much get 100% propaganda. Facts will be exaggerated, cherry-picked, deceptively phrased, or otherwise misleading. Normally, you will have no way of guessing the specific way in which the information is deceptive, making the information essentially worthless for drawing inferences. Best example of ideological propaganda as you've researched the New York Times history?
I would say that it was the New York Times presentation of early Soviet Russia as this sort of socialist wonderland, where they would have, they actually had a reporter named Ella Winter, who was a Soviet agent. She was a Soviet propaganda agent. She was printing news articles in the New York Times about how amazing Russia was under the Soviets. And also you had prominent intellectuals like George Bernard Shaw writing about what a wonderful place this was and how everyone was like going out to the opera in Moscow, where we know the brutal realities that were existing at that time. That was a really glaring example of just pure outright propaganda that had no connection to reality.
And what was the Walter Duranty issue with the Holodomor? Could you briefly explain that that was another Soviet misinformation operation?
Yeah, that was concurrent. And, you know, that actually I would say that's actually a more of an American misinformation operation than a Soviet one, strangely. So Durante covered up the Ukraine famine, which was Stalin's successful effort, tragically, to murder between five and seven million people in Ukraine, peasants, who refused to go along with his collectivization plans. And so he just killed them by starving them. This was evident to anyone who had eyes and was present at the time in those areas. Durante, who was the New York Times' Russia correspondent, he saw and knew exactly what was going on, yet his reporting carried the line that there was no famine in Ukraine whatsoever. There was some hardships and difficulties, but no famine. He denied the reporting of other reporters who claimed that there was. The reason he did it was because the New York Times was part of a consortium of big American business that really wanted to get back into the Russian market. They had the connection between the US and the Russia and those marketplaces had been disrupted by the revolution, and big American companies wanted access to that market of 150 million people that was rapidly industrializing. It was really too good an opportunity to pass up. That depended on trade relationships, which in turn depended on the US recognizing the legitimacy of the Soviet government, which they had not done. The US government had not done up until that point. But you were never going to convince the American people that the US government should recognize a regime if it had just murdered 5 million of its own people. So Durante was called upon to deny that that happened. And when the recognition actually did take place, there was a big gala banquet at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, including the ambassador to the US, the Russian ambassador to the US, and his counterpart, the American ambassador to Russia, to the USSR, and a lot of other luminaries, including the head of Ford Motors and GM and major banks, JP Morgan and Chase Manhattan. Everybody was there. Walter Durante was the only person that night to get a standing ovation because they all understood exactly what he had done for the cause. So this, we tend to think this is all about, you know, ideology, but, and to my earlier point, a lot of it is about money. And that, in that case, I think that's what it was.
Yes, good points there. Here is an article from the Times on August 12th, 2017, Why Women Had Better Sex Under Socialism. The subheading is Red Century. Now, I've exhausted all of my articles. I should have gone to archive.org for this. But either way, notice how anything related to Ron DeSantis, governor in America, or Donald Trump, immediately it goes to white supremacy and things that are, terrible. Well, with socialism, you have government supremacy, far deadlier than white supremacy. And Thomas Sowell made the point that governments, if you take just the Japanese imperialists, the national socialists, they killed about the number of people they killed in Manchuria in about 5 days is the equivalent of all Ku Klux Klan murders that existed throughout American history. So yeah, look, the Klan was evil, and it's important to recognize that, but we also need some perspective. So when we speak about socialism in a, well, look at the benefits, it's literally like saying, look at the benefits of white supremacy and how American blacks are wealthier than those in Sierra Leone. It should be that offensive and that evil when we hear something like, intercourse was better under socialism. Oh, okay. We got two more of these. So he says the second category is sensationalism. Mainstream news sources make money by getting as many people as possible to watch their shows, read their articles, and so on. To do that, they try to make everything sound as scary, exciting, outrageous, or otherwise dramatic as possible. Best example of sensationalism in your research on the New York Times.
Sensationalism, I would say, is, you know, in the context of my book, which was more historical up until the 1619 Project, I would say it was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was the story of that decade, to show that there were WMDs in Iraq was just a huge scoop, and everybody wanted that scoop. And that's even what the executive editor of the New York Times at that point, Howell Raines, came out when he was appointed not long before that, came out saying, we're going to go get the scoops. We're going to maintain our competitive metabolism. That's sort of the euphemism he used to describe that. And they got that huge scoop. It was absolutely sensational. It was a spectacular win for the New York Times. And it bolstered the Bush administration's case for war in Iraq. And it wasn't true. They got so carried away with their own sensationalistic reporting on it that they neglected to actually verify and corroborate those claims. And you get to this moment in the climax of this reporting where Judith Miller, who was a New York Times reporter, the infamous reporter on this issue, was watching a source, quote unquote source, stand 100 feet away from her in the desert of Iraq, pointing at the ground, saying that's where the weapons used to be. And she wasn't even able to approach the guy to shake his hand to ask his name. She just had to look at some random person pointing at the ground, and that was a source. And that's the dangers of that kind of reporting, is that it's not real reporting. You're just reporting the headline and then filling out the rest of the story afterwards.
Third, laziness. Most people who write for public consumption are lazy and lack expertise about the things they write about. If a story has some technical aspect, example, science news, journalists probably won't understand it, and they may get basic facts backwards. Also, they often just talk to one or a few sources and print whatever those sources say, even if the sources have obvious biases. Best example of laziness in your research on the New York Times?
I would say there was the famous case in the Second Intifada in Israel, Palestinian uprising, where the New York Times printed a very, very influential and incendiary photo of what they supposed to be a Palestinian man being beaten mercilessly by an Israeli soldier. And that's the caption they ran to explain that photo. They were alerted to the fact by the father of the person being beaten that was not a Palestinian being beaten by an Israeli soldier. It was a Jewish student, American Jewish student, who was being effectively lynched by a Palestinian mob. And the soldier in the photo was protecting him. Now, one of the things that the caption said was that this was taking place on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, was the hot spot, which fit the entire narrative of the New York Times, that all this is religious war that was going on. But if you looked at the photo, there was a gas station in the photo, and you just don't need to think that hard to understand that there's no gas station on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the holiest place in Judaism and one of the holy sites of Islam. And that's just laziness. But it's also a bit more than laziness. It's also a bit, you know, the agenda was so strong, the narrative was so strong, that it actually blinded them to what was in front of their face, that namely, there can't be a gas station on the Temple Mount. Nobody saw that. None of the many editors and photo editors, layout editors noticed that fact. So that's a pretty good one. And it's connected to a larger issue there, which was Israel was accused of murdering a Palestinian boy, where, again, there was actually no evidence that took place in the way they said it did. And when it was actually examined by a French court and a French forensics expert in a separate trial, it was found that it was impossible. The New York Times never did the hard work. They hadn't had any people on the ground reporting that story. They just took it as an accepted fact, and they kept printing it again and again and again and again. And it was something that was used as a justification. The death of this little boy was used to justify the murder of reporter, Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl, not that long after. So this is the kind of laziness that becomes extremely dangerous as well.
Now, well, we've all seen the videos and photos of people escaping Cuba on these rafts built of garbage so they can hopefully get to America, escaping Castro to come to a much more free market economy where there is more opportunity. You have shown in your book that the New York Times was a vital tool that was used by Castro and his collaborators to take power in Cuba. What evidence do you have for this very interesting story?
Yeah, that's something. I think it's one of these things that, you know, it's pretty clearly, if you look at the facts and the timelines, Fidel Castro was not really a relevant force at the time. He was sort of a nothing, nobody. In the late 1950s, he'd run out of men and guns and money, and he was hiding out in the mountains. The Batista regime wasn't even looking for him at that point. And then along comes the New York Times reporter and declares him to be Cuba's democratic savior, messiah of democracy, and does it not just in one article, but again and again and again and again and again, till Castro is the hottest good in town. I mean, he at that moment, the Soviets were turned on to him. Money started to flow his way. Guns were flowing his way. And it was only 2 years later that he was able to actually stage the revolution. He himself went to New York, went to the New York Times building. It was on Times Square at that period, and thanked the editor, the publisher, for what they had done for him. And Che Guevara, of course, his trusted lieutenant, also made a similar claim, saying that Herbert Matthews, who was the reporter that went to Cuba in 1957, had done more for the cause, the Castro's cause, than any fighter, any soldier on the battlefield. And that was just obviously the case, because what Castro needed more than money and guns was relevance, and that's what the New York Times gave him.
And just one final question. I saw the Theodore Herzl painting behind you, and I just had to ask. I went to Temple Emmanuel in Arizona, so it was more of a Reformed temple. I was eventually bar mitzvah there, and I sort of felt like I got some fake news when I had not heard about the original Palestinian mistreatment groups like Ergon and Haganah within the British Mandate of Palestine, things like the Balfour Declaration. If one wants to get a good understanding of Israeli history and maybe what's going on now, are there any books, essays, articles, podcasts, things you would recommend people look into to get a more accurate view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
It's a very thorny and complex issue, of course. There are plenty of great books. I would hesitate to offer just one at this point. I think it's good to start with Herzl. I mean, Theodor Herzl was the founder of the political Zionist movement. And to read his books is a very interesting exercise, just to know the context of it and what was going on. And I think to understand, at least from an Israeli point of view, the narrative doesn't start in 1948 when Israel declared independence, or even in the 30s, or even in the 19th century when Herzl was around and working. It's a very deep and long history of an attachment to this particular land and an indigenous attachment to it, and one that competes with another nation and another group of people. So, you know, I think where we tend to fall into, again, is one of this Manichaean good versus evil, and depending on which side you're on, if you're a Democrat today or on the left, you think the Israelis are evil, Palestinians are good little lambs, and if you're on the right, you think the opposite. But I think if you look at it as more of a level playing field, say two people, one place, they're competing for the same thing, both have various claims, how do we go forward from there, I think is the focus that people need to start to ask about. But I would just say read widely, read deeply, avoid the really loud claims people are making about the buzz terms, and try to get the facts for yourself where you can find them.
The book is The Gray Lady Winked, How the New York Times' Misreporting Distortions and Fabrications Radically Alter History. Thanks to everyone for watching. Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, in the Libertarian Institute. Ashley Rinsberg, thank you so much for being generous with your time.
Thank you, Keith. My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.